it's sort of like novelists. Whenever you read a book, you're getting the benefit of someone's life's work that they've put into book form. And I really think of founders that way. You know, anytime I meet a founder, I'm absorbing something that they've been working on for years, or sometimes decades, sometimes longer than I've been alive. And I just love diving into something and learning about a new industry and learning about a new way that this industry is being looked at by people who have been, frankly, oftentimes confined by the sort of traditional industry, and see this opportunity of sort of what the world could become.
The startup investment landscape is changing, and world-class companies are being built outside of Silicon Valley. We find them, talk with them, and discuss the upside of investing in them.
Welcome to Upside.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Upside Podcast, the first podcast finding upside outside of Silicon Valley. I'm Jay Klaus, and I'm accompanied by my co-host, Mr. Tasty Spreadsheets himself, Eric Hornung.
Ooh, tasty spreadsheets. I love a good tasty spreadsheet, Jay. You know I love to play in spreadsheets in general, but whenever I see a spreadsheet that you put together, I can't help but go and just format it like crazy.
I can't help but make it much, much better. Yeah, last night I was in our production spreadsheet checking out one of the tabs. I had an idea that I was going to put in for a future editorial, and I saw that you had completely reformatted that page, and I thought, oh, what a guy.
Well, I just thought that rather than have a list, I thought it was better as a storyboard, and the concept of storyboarding in Excel looked pretty nice, and so I just kind of laid it out there, and now we got a little status dropdown. One of the biggest things in Excel that you can do just to like up your usability, because I want the users to be able to do something. So I'm changing the word a little bit. Is data validation, which is those drop-down lists, game changing?
You've taught me those. I know how to do those now.
Really? I did teach you. Good for me. Look at that.
Yeah. No, I learned from you, and it's useful. It's useful in our, we now have a Google alert set up for our Podfolio companies. So when they get into the news, we track that article, and I use the data validation column so I can mark which company it is related to, and then we can sort by the companies.
Fantastic. So I love spreadsheets because you can lay out things very well. There's a new software that I really want to learn that I haven't had the chance yet, but I'm hoping 2019 I'm going to make it a goal to learn Airtable.
2019 is the year of the Airtable.
I've heard nothing but great things, and I think that it will be very beneficial for us. And I really think that it's one of those things that in venture capital, you have to have some solid technical skills in Excel and PowerPoint and Word, being able to write, read, speak, explain via numbers.
Sing, dance, pretend.
Oh, triple threat. Like our friend Rachel. There you go. And I think Airtable lets you do those a lot more seamlessly than Excel. So I'm always trying to build up the skill set that great venture capitalists have.
That's right. And speaking of venture capital, our guest today is Monique Villa. Monique is the founder of Modern Capital in Nashville, Tennessee. She's also on the investment team for Mucker Capital, which is based in LA. Monique is living in Nashville, and today she's going to be speaking to us about her path getting into venture capital, beginning with working at a startup company, why venture capital is a space that she's been interested in and continued working in, and now what her role looks like as she's sort of the Southeast ambassador of Mucker Capital, looking for companies in the Southeast, which she'll define the boundaries of that, to invest in, aligning with our thesis of being outside of Silicon Valley. So I'm excited about this conversation with Monique.
Tons of overlap here between us and Monique, I think, I'm expecting, but I'm just really excited to hear kind of her path and now what she's doing in the Southeast.
That's right. Modern Capital is a collective of creative thinkers from the private, public, and civic sectors shaping the modern economy, is from their website. So excited to hear from Monique about Modern Capital, about her work at Mucker, about her path getting up to Mucker. Eric, you ready to dive in?
Let's do it.
Monique, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's great having you here. Monique, we like to start with a question about the guest and your history. So can you tell us about the history of Monique?
Well, start from the very beginning. No, I'm just kidding. So I live in Nashville, Tennessee. I moved here a year ago from LA, where I was an LA native, Long Beach, California, to be exact. And there were five of us natives running around LA, and then I left. So I was one less person who's still there, but I visit frequently. But I'm really enjoying being a Nashvillian now, which is a way cooler title.
Are you saying that there are only five born and raised LA Long Beachers and that it's mostly tourists? Or what were you saying with that?
Not just Long Beach, all of LA. Like LA natives, we would get really excited when we'd bump into one another every year. We'd say, oh, really? You're from here too? And everyone's confused by you too? That's great. Nice to meet you. So yeah, I think I counted about five.
Interesting. Okay. So what spurred the move to Nashville?
I love this question because when I moved here a year ago, that was what I was answering about 10 times a day. People would say, so what? Why are you here? What's going on? And what inspired the move? So my husband's a songwriter, and I did a check-in with him one day in LA and said, hey, how's LA going? And he's like, great. I'd love to check out Nashville one day. He really wanted to make sure that I loved it before we committed to moving across the country. And so I came for the first time in May of 2017, and it really was, you know, love at first sight. I fell in love with it. I was so excited to be here. It felt right to be here. And so we ended up progressing really quickly and bought a home and picked up and moved.
What about it felt so right?
Yeah. So I think there's some similarities being from LA and looking at Nashville. So Nashville has quite a few pockets and neighborhoods, and it's decentralized in that way. It's not oriented around a single town square. And because of that, you get lots of variety. So you could almost joke that there's a neighborhood for every stage of your life if you wanted to move around. And because of that, I just always thought that there was something fun to do. It was relaxing. You know, I'm a sucker for really good coffee and food and yeah, just all of the things. And so I saw that right away, and people were so incredibly nice. People, like, you'll hear that from anyone from Nashville who's spent time in Nashville. They'll say that everyone's nice and they're not looking for something from you other than just to be a nice person. So I think that's something that is really unique.
How's that last part compared to LA?
So Nashville is decentralized in that there's many neighborhoods across the city, and each neighborhood has its own flavor and its own variety of things to do and people to talk to. And it's just one of those things where you can't possibly get bored. It's a big city and there's something opening every single day, it seems. I'm really just enjoying getting to know each and every corner of Nashville. It's a great place to be.
So right now you are the founder of Modern Capital and on the investment team for Mucker, which is based in LA. I can't imagine you started in VC. You had to get there somehow. So how did you find your way towards venture capital and investing?
Yeah, so it really started with an internship in college. I interned for Tom's Shoes and took a quarter off of school. And my parents thought I was absolutely out of my mind because they had never heard of the shoe company. It was 2008. And they said, why are you dropping out of college to work for a shoe company? And it's like, well, they're so cool. And they put shoes on kids' feet. And the mission just really landed with me. And so through that internship, I ended up diving headfirst into operating within a startup and never once was asked to get coffee. It was just, hey, we're going to launch this pop-up store. We need an accounting and inventory system. Or, hey, we're going to send five teams across the country to sell shoes. Let's figure out how to run that. And from that, I just really was bit by the startup bug, for lack of a cooler way to describe that. And so after college, I took a job at a digital entertainment startup consultancy and worked on BD and strategic partnerships for our clients. Very early stage companies, but most of the time, they would come in, pitch, we would say, no, that's probably not going to be your business model. And we'd help them find that product market fit. And from there, I actually met my would-be boss at an event in LA, and they were starting a first-time fund and recruiting. And they were looking for someone to build out investor relations, but also to build out the firm. And so most people don't realize that a VC is effectively a startup when it launches. And so I joined in month 5, and I brought with me these experiences, you know, in the weeds, working with a startup that was scaling quickly, and also helping to consult and advise early stage startups in a really fraught industry of entertainment. And when I got into venture, I didn't really understand fully how a firm worked, but it was learning on the job, as the best jobs are. And so I ended up doing everything from fundraising, so working closely with LPs from all around the world and of all sizes and backgrounds, and, you know, onboarded those LPs, and then did everything from wiring money to companies to making sure that our company filed our first taxes and our audit and everything else. So I was really in the weeds with the operations of the firm, but also the flow of capital from LP to startup.
So when you were with Tom's in 2008, how big was that team? How big was the company?
When I joined, they had just reached 40 full-time in-house, and there were 13, I believe, of us interns that actually worked full-time for the winter. So we were there Monday through Friday. We were living in a house together. We would carpool together. We would figure out creative, very affordable lunches together. It was a really special time. And I mean, to give you some context, at that point in time, there was no real budget for any sort of advertising or marketing. And so what we had were these sort of postcard sized, you know, pieces of collateral that we'd walk around and hand them out to people when we were at events and so forth. But aside from that, it was really, really, you know, on paper, it was small, but I'd say that the weight that was being pulled was really, really significant. You know, we were on stage at, you know, the United Nations and the Clinton Global Initiative, and we're working to bring shoes to Haiti, and had been selling in Whole Foods and Urban Outfitters, and had some really significant distribution at that point in time. But it really came together in January after my internship, when Blake, the CEO, was on an AT&T commercial walking around saying that he used his AT&T phone to put shoes on kids' feet. And then all of a sudden, I didn't have to explain to everybody that we weren't the toothpaste company. Because every time I said Tom's, and they'd say, oh, like the toothpaste. It's like, no, we're a shoe company. And so I'm grateful to AT&T for helping connect the dots.
That's really funny. I have thought that before, too, when I saw the toothpaste. Actually, I was aware of the shoes before the toothpaste. And Tom's was founded in 2006, so you were there pretty early on, it sounds like, both by the size of the team you mentioned and the year.
It was a really fun time, and I was only 19 years old. I was the youngest I was the second to youngest person in our warehouse that was just a sea of desks and boxes. But what was really powerful about that, and I think it's important for people who are looking for internships or first roles in startups, is being able to see the lay of the land. So I could actually visualize all the different departments and how they were working together, because we were in one big space. People talk about open concept. This was a warehouse. Like, we didn't have any walls. And I think that was really what set off, you know, the rest of my, you know, continuing pursuits in my career.
So creative, affordable lunches. That's an interesting thing to bring up when you're talking about your experience. What was a creative, affordable lunch?
So anything that you could make from the Trader Joe's frozen aisle and reheat was always a good thing. Rice, like lots of rice-based dishes, because you could buy a big bag of rice. Yeah, any sort of hack that would make one meal into three was pretty much the name of the game, because, you know, when you're interning and you're excited about what you're doing, you're not necessarily flush in lunch money.
So I'm sorry, I think you said this and I missed it. You moved on from Tom's to the early stages at a venture firm?
Yeah, so after college, I went and worked for a digital entertainment consulting firm focused on BD and strategic partnerships. And, you know, the entertainment industry at that time was going through a lot. It was sort of post-streaming, you know, post brick and mortar shops starting to close and trying to figure out a way to monetize the entertainment industry. And across, this applies to film and TV as well, incredibly difficult. And so the startups we were working with, we would help them really closely on their business models and figure out who they should be talking to and when, and, you know, how they could actually create this product market fit for them. So after that, I ended up, you know, meeting my would-be boss at an event in LA, and he was starting a first-time fund. He'd moved out from Boston. He had been in Bain Capital for a number of years. And he's like, hey, we're starting this new fund here in LA and Singapore. We're recruiting. And he was really just building a team. Like, this definition of a startup is if you are building something, and they were in, you know, month five when I joined, but every single person you meet practically on the street, you're pretty much figuring out if they'll be your next hire. Like, you're just on the prowl for talent. And so, yeah, so I ended up accepting a role there in investor relations, and, you know, did everything from that month five point, from fundraising to onboarding RLPs to wiring money to companies, to also making sure that our company was a company. So I, you know, telling the city of LA that we were indeed a company, and that, you know, we filed our taxes and we performed our first audit, and, you know, we really started sketching out what was this, you know, overall operation going to mean for our founders and also for our investors.
When you say between LA and Singapore, can you elaborate a little bit on that and what was it like working internationally?
Yeah, so we had our headquarters in LA. We were in Westwood near UCLA. And in Singapore, we had our chairman and a number of LPs. And so we spent some time there, but really our thesis was all around, you know, tech-enabled consumer products and emerging markets. So we weren't looking for San Francisco-based companies. We were sort of looking outside of San Francisco, but also in Southeast Asia, where we saw a big opportunity. It was, in terms of how it was like, it was fascinating. I love Southeast Asia. You know, I went to Singapore and I went to Jakarta and got to know companies out there and investors, and found a really phenomenal and close-knit community that was also still getting to know one another. And also just a really brutal time zone difference, because if you're, you know, leaving the office at 6:30 p.m. in LA, it's 9:30 a.m. most of the year in Singapore. And so your inbox starts to fill up again. But yeah, I really fell in love with that part of the world, and I look forward to going back.
You are drawing some parallels in my mind to a former guest that we had that you may have crossed paths with there, Peter Brock. Did you work with Peter at all?
So I didn't know Peter at that point in time, but he's actually an advisor with Mucker. So now I've gotten to know him in my new capacity.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's talked about when he moved to LA and started working with Mucker and started identifying that as an emerging ecosystem. And of course, he spent some time in Singapore as well. Just a fun small world moment.
It really is.
Can you give us some examples of the kinds of companies you were looking at in Southeast Asia, specifically in the tech-enabled consumer space?
Yeah. So actually, one of the ones that we were considering during one of my trips out there, we ended up investing in, they were doing essentially an e-commerce delivery for baby products. And there was this sort of larger thesis around, you know, the quote unquote middle class in the world defined by having discretionary income is how we were thinking about it, was growing in line with population growth, but also through efficiencies and new sort of tools that people had in their pockets on the mobile side. And so what we saw in Indonesia, which is where this company was based, they were based in Jakarta, they realized that these parents could not buy what they needed for their babies or for their toddlers in any simple way. There wasn't any home delivery at that point for those types of products. So they actually had these warehouses filled with products like, you know, baby wipes and snacks and, you know, all the little things. And you could order it online and it would show up to your door. And it was delivered by essentially a delivery person on the back of a motorcycle or like a motorized, any, like you name it, they would stack up 10 large boxes, cover it in plastic, and it would show up to your door. The thing that was really, you know, beyond that being a novel service, I would say the part that it really exposed was how difficult it was to pay for something on an e-commerce platform, at least in that point in time. I know that there's been some progress that's been made, but if you bought something, you would essentially have to buy it online, go down to your bank and initiate the equivalence of a wire. And then on the backside of that, the company would have to manually match the order they received with essentially the line in their ledger of their banking account that they had received the money. And so there were these pieces that I'd say were overlooked by investors that might have been doing e-commerce plays in other parts of the world. But what Indonesia was contending with is something that many countries do. And so we developed some really strong conviction around the team, and that company ended up doing really well.
So I want to clarify where we're at on the timeline.
That was my first fund.
Yeah, this is Core Innovation Capital, right?
That's Velos Partners.
Velos Partners. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. No, because you asked me about how I got into VC. So I went down the rabbit hole of jobs prior to VC and then what I jumped into.
Awesome. I just want to make sure
I'm happy to fast forward.
All right, Jay. So if you want to take it from there, knowing what we know now about that.
Okay. So what year about was this that you were at? And this was Velos Partners?
Velos Partners. Yeah. I was at Velos through, I guess it was 2013, 2014. And so we actually fully fundraised that fund and deployed it. And it was just a phenomenal learning experience. We had such an incredible network of investors and founders. And that's really when I decided that I wanted to pursue venture for the long haul. And it was because you have this benefit of seeing hundreds and hundreds of companies and figuring out frameworks that you can actually share back with founders to say, all right, you're at this point in your you know, growth. Here's a couple things to consider. Here's some things to be aware of so that you're not hopefully not misstepping as much as you might without that sort of visibility.
And what was it about having those frameworks and working with multiple founders that you liked more than, say, jumping into another early stage startup yourself or starting a early stage startup yourself?
So I'd say you're definitely learning at a pace that, even though you're learning obviously rapidly and spending your entire life working, you know, and operating within a startup, what I really loved is it's sort of like novelists. Whenever you read a book, you're getting the benefit of someone's life's work that they've put into book form. And I really think of founders that way. You know, anytime I meet a founder, I'm absorbing something that they've been working on for years or sometimes decades, sometimes longer than I've been alive. And I just love diving into something and learning about a new industry and learning about a new way that this industry is being looked at by people who have been, frankly, oftentimes confined by the sort of traditional industry and see this opportunity of sort of what the world could become. So I really love that aspect of it. And then I love the challenge of, all right, so you want to do this thing, this impossible, seemingly irrational thing to build a business from scratch. Let me figure out a way to help you. And so I really love that service capacity for, you know, for venture.
That is my favorite way I've ever heard, like, why venture described to me. And I think it also fits extremely well with why I personally am doing this podcast. I love that metaphor as founders and guests as books and being able to learn so much from them. That was an incredible answer.
Oh, thank you. No, I really believe it. And it's obviously been a learning curve, and at every turn there's a surprise, but that's sort of what I signed up for.
I'm going to steal that, by the way.
Please do. Okay. It's yours.
From Velos, it looks like you moved on to something called Network for Teaching Entrepreneurship. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So that was a total surprise, as everything is. And so I ended up meeting the board chair of this organization on a startup crawl in Santa Monica, of all things. So imagine walking down the street between startup offices. And I think we both were talking to someone else and had some form of, you know, combination of keywords that triggered the other person. And it was around youth entrepreneurship. And so, you know, I sort of helped out around Kane's Arcade, and my friend's a really talented filmmaker who put that out. And I helped out around the edges and became really passionate about creativity for kids. And so, yeah, he was also talking about something similar. And I ended up discovering this organization. It's been around at that point for 27 years and was all around in-class curriculum to teach people, essentially students, middle school and high school, about entrepreneurship. And then going all the way through the business plan competition, but specifically focused on low-income communities. At that point in time, you know, Velos had already deployed the fund. I was frankly completely exhausted by the time difference and also trying really hard to get married. I was engaged for almost a year at that point and couldn't even think about actually planning a wedding or being in a wedding. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll work for a nonprofit that's doing really great work and I'll be able to at least fix my time zone issue. And I did, and I ended up loving it. I ran an accelerator program. We worked really closely with Citi. And then also in the in-class program, we worked closely with EY and MasterCard. So, you know, partially focused on our corporate partnerships, but also our in-class programming, supporting teachers. We launched 13 businesses during the summer with the accelerator program called Startup Summer. I just really enjoyed the entire process, but I think more than anything else, I had been in a position before where I was working with LPs that were high net worth individuals with very significant net worth to their name. And I then went and worked with low income, middle and high school students. And I was able to draw quite a few parallels between those seemingly disparate populations. And it really came down to talent, talent and motivation. Like, someone has some level of talent, and how are they motivated to do something with that talent? And I was just really fascinated by the juxtaposition, the fact that I went from an investor relations role to working in the nonprofit capacity.
And this is after you realized that venture was where you wanted to be.
Oh yeah. And that's just it. Like, I didn't see them frankly as different. Like, I was definitely at a different part of the food chain. Like, you know, people are like, oh, you're working for a nonprofit. And very different from, oh, you work for a venture firm. It's like, what? I'm the same person and I'm still building companies. And no, but I really thought that it would be sort of a course correction, because when you're working and building something from scratch, and any startup or, you know, first time fund will tell you this, like, your health suffers, you're not sleeping. Like, it's just a brutal trajectory. And I thought I'd correct that, but then we ended up working incredibly hard, and I don't know that I actually I wasn't having the predictable 9 to 5 or 9 to 6, you know, situation that I thought I might, but I absolutely loved every second of it.
Did you pull off a wedding in that time?
I did. I got married and I kept my husband, who actually saw me. Like, I was around. It was great. I'm so glad that it worked out. I think it was definitely the right call. I'm, you know, certain life events you can't skip over.
And I'm sure there's a lot that we can unpack from that experience with the nonprofit, but I want to kind of keep moving forward
here.
Yeah,
of course.
And you then moved on to another venture firm.
Yeah, so I joined Core Innovation Capital. You know, I'd known the firm for several years because they were friends with our team at Velos Partners. And so that's actually where the job came from. One of my friends who was on the investment team there reached out because they were looking to bring someone on. And so my role was really focused on scaling our firm's operations, because we had two funds at that point in time in year 5. And so year 5 looks significantly different from month 5 of a firm. And given my background with investor relations, and I mean, I was even like our unofficial CFO at Velos, but, you know, I showing up at Core had some of those pieces that I could pull in and figure out how to work best with our LPs and our broader network. So we were fintech-focused fund, specifically looking for double bottom line consumer value plays. And our entire network was concentrated in financial services. So we had, you know, over 7,000 contacts in financial services, and figuring out how we could best leverage our resources to support our portfolio I think that's something that's really important for sector-focused funds.
What is a double bottom line consumer value product?
Yeah, so there's quite a few that we've found, and actually we believe that this space is continuing to grow. So looking at something like Opportune, they're based out of Redwood City. They have actually built an entire operation around brick and mortar locations targeting the Hispanic community, doing small dollar personal loans. And their average loan size, at least a couple years ago, was $750. But they were able to leverage technology to improve their underwriting process and then focus their operations all around helping the consumer pay back that loan by really getting them across the finish line of paying that, making that first payment. And then once you make that first payment, then you have a much higher, you know, ability to actually get it paid back.
What does the actual phrase double bottom line mean?
Yeah, so double bottom line is really around if you have a company that's doing well and doing good at the same time, is how we described it. So doing well financially, so we have an absolute mandate to return money to our investors. So we're looking for very commercially minded enterprises that are going to scale quickly and make, you know, a great return. But also on the other side, we believe that producing some element of consumer value, a product that's going to actually be a good product or service for the end user and the consumer, we believe that that actually begets the scalability, because people become incredibly loyal if you're providing them with a great service. So in fintech, making sure that these are financial products that aren't going to, you know, burn and pillage, but actually help people in their financial lives.
So you've gone through early stage VC, and sorry, not early stage as in early stage investor, but 5 month old VC, accelerator / nonprofit, 5 year old VC, and you understand that going and starting your own thing is not a 9-to-6 job. So you move to Nashville and start your own thing. Can you tell us about how those experiences kind of culminated in starting Modern Capital?
Yeah, so I'd say that everything, besides the fact that, you know, I've been working with startups throughout, I think it really helped me identify needs in the market because of seeing it from slightly different vantage points. And so when I came to Nashville, I said, you know what, I don't know a single thing about this part of the country. I need to learn about it. So I hopped in the car and I started meeting people who were founders and investors and ecosystem builders. And I visited, you know, Birmingham and Huntsville and Memphis and Louisville and Chattanooga and Knoxville and the Triangle and Atlanta and like you name it. And so I was just learning. I needed to figure out what is it that I could contribute to this community long term now that I'm going to be here for a long time. And people were incredibly welcoming, but I was also really impressed with the level of sort of context that they were happy to share. You know, they would say, hey, like, I've been building this company for 2 years. Here's what I've been facing. Here's what I'd really love. Here's what I think the city would really benefit from. And so it all directed me into this direction that there was this, you know, large discrepancy in communication between this part of the country and the rest of the country. And that really surprised me. And also it surprised me that even within the region, there was relatively little connectivity. So I would go visit, you know, one city that was maybe a couple hours away from another city and somehow be the person introducing people to one another who had been there for decades. And I was here in, you know, my own month five, right? It's like, how could this be possible? How do you not know each other? And so it was a total phenomenon to me. And so I knew that I needed to create something new that would help facilitate that community.
When you made that move, you're still with Mucker right now, and that's based in LA. You're living in Nashville. Are you helping Mucker to find companies in, I know your thing is built in the Southeast, in the Southeast?
Yeah. So the story there is one of the partners, Will at Mucker, has been a mentor of mine for a number of years. We actually met when I was at Nifty working for the nonprofit. And, you know, I really admired him and thought that he had a very unique view of the world. And so when I was starting to build Modern Capital here in Nashville, I had gone back to LA to visit, and I was reaching out to some people for advice. And so I took him out to lunch and told him what I was doing. And I really did it so he could poke holes in my logic and thought process, because I knew there would be many. And a month later, he offered me a role. And so Modern Capital, actually, in building that community, led to Mucker, where Mucker didn't have any operations here previously, being headquartered in LA for the past 7 years. And so, you know, I joined Mucker's team in July of 2018. And I am looking at companies that are in not just the Southeast, but sort of this radius around Nashville, because Nashville has, you know, over half of the US population within a 650-mile radius. So it's a pretty compelling advantage to be here and to be investing.
I'm trying to think about like how your brain works from this perspective, where it's,
yeah,
I go, I see a company, am I Mucker or am I Modern?
It works really well. So Mucker is I'm in a full-time capacity on the investment team, and Mucker invests pre-seed and seed, predominantly seed, but we also invest pre-seed with what we call Mucker Lab, which is a sort of annual cohort model for an accelerator program. And that's first and foremost, you know, I think the immediate conversation that I have with founders, because especially founders who are fundraising or gearing up to fundraise, that's definitely cash flow is real, right? So that's usually like the beginning of our conversation. And then on the Modern Capital side, our mission is really to build community in the Southeast. And so we're doing that through research, publishing content as we gather those findings, and then we're starting to host events. But with that, it's supported by a network that's growing of venture fellows. And these are people who are, you know, either in college, college graduates, MBA students, maybe working for a startup locally, but really wanting to understand a little bit more about the venture capital industry as a whole. And so we're helping to sort of fill in those gaps and provide context through the research and through the content we're creating and the networks that we're creating, but also figuring out how we can help those founders and connecting them with people around the country. So it's that's definitely much more a direct community building mechanism. And it's something that even when I'm talking to founders that might not be a good fit for Mucker, they're genuinely excited that there's this ethos around community building and collaboration. And so then we end up having an excuse to stay in touch much longer than if it was like we're not going to work together in this other capacity.
Has Modern Capital raised a fund, or have you deployed any investments?
So we actually are backed by Launch Tennessee. They provided us with grant funding that pays for the Venture Fellows program and also our operational expenses. So I'm not financially part of that. I just really wanted to build this. And I believe that Modern Capital will go on. I'd love to become a B Corp, honestly, and really scale the team and you know, make it a true Southeast effort that many, many hubs participate in.
So I read your post on, I think it was your post on Medium about the launch of Modern Capital.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points that was reiterated a couple times was this idea of connecting Nashville to specifically LA, but also just the general Silicon Valley coastal capital. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, in addition to the community building you mentioned, the connection facilitation.
Yeah. So I'd say it's even more broad than LA or Silicon Valley. I think collectively the team has a network that spans the country and in all parts of the country. And so the idea is that if we meet a founder and we get to know the founder, and the founder says, hey, I'm at this point in my lifespan, right? Like, I'm just starting out. I'm looking for advisors. I don't have a single dollar in revenue, all the way to I have a company that's doing $25 million in ARR and we're looking for our next growth round. I think that because we are really just looking to get to know them, we can go back to our community and say, hey, who would be a couple people that we could introduce them to that would be really helpful? And so it's really informal in that capacity, and it's pretty casual. And we don't have any interest in becoming the consultant for the fundraise either. We just want to sort of do the service of saying, can we help you do this a little more efficiently? Because otherwise, founders, as you know, are sort of left to scouring the internet and trying to extract somehow all of these insights from very vague websites. And that's something I experienced when I was working on the consulting side, because company would say, hey, should we talk to this VC firm? And I had no clue what, you know, fill in the blank VC's website was supposed to tell me about their strategy. It's very hit or miss. And so we just want to be supportive in that capacity.
So Monique, I imagine at some point, probably even early on when you're with Tom's, you looked around and realized that this whole industry is male dominated. And that's a trend that you've been bucking your entire career, right? So can you talk about what that's been like and why you think you've had such a sort of seamless transition into the venture world?
Yeah, so I'd say it has been fascinating to see what has happened within the venture capital community in the past year alone. So it's something that it never occurred to me that it would even happen or that it would be a topic. You know, I think it was just so much more of a reality that you sort of just work within it and that's about it. And so more recently, what we saw was that venture firms specifically can disappear overnight because of their agreements and the way that agreements are structured with their investors, their LPs. And so I think that created an incentive, unlike any other industry, to sort of course correct and make sure that there was representation around the table, that there are women and other underrepresented communities at the table that are making these decisions and directing billions and billions of dollars into companies that are going to shape the future. Also, beyond that, my background is my dad's Mexican, and so I'm half Mexican, and there's actually only 29 Latina VCs in the country. There's a list that one of my friends, Maria from Unshackled, put together with a couple of other investors. But I'd say that my path has been anything but seamless. It's been absolutely just tons and tons and tons of work, pounding the pavement, meeting people, figuring out how everyone works together. You know, I didn't come from a traditional background. I chose not to get an MBA. I didn't study finance in undergrad. And so everything that I've done has had to be entirely different in order to get to this point in time. And I think because of that, it's back in line with your question around what's going on and what is it like to be, you know, a woman or an underrepresented entity in this industry. I'd say that it's only benefiting me because I'm interacting and helping and supporting companies in a totally different way than arguably someone else who doesn't have my same background or my same vantage point.
What's the future of the Southeast venture ecosystem?
One of the biggest mistakes people make when they talk about different parts of the country or between the coasts, or, you know, even people use these terms around tier 2, tier 3 cities. I think that's entirely false. And in the Southeast, there's an incredibly strong foundation in industries and deep domain expertise that's serving founders incredibly well. And then as people are moving into the area, because we are seeing this distribution of people unlike ever before across the country, when they come to those areas, they get the benefit of that deep domain expertise. And they also are bringing in new ideas for those. And so on the capital side, I think the biggest shift we're seeing is that instead of people, capital is no longer the magnet. People aren't following capital, quote unquote, in the same way that, you know, we did at the advent of Wall Street, for example, right? Like, put on your suit, you go down to Wall Street. Wall Street's actually moving, and that's happening across the country. And so capital is also now realizing that talent is the strongest magnet. And so capital is following the talent. And I'm seeing this here, even in my 1 year being here, in that people are increasingly willing to get on planes, showing up to conferences. They get here, they start home shopping because they realize that it's an incredible place to be. And I think in the next 5 years, but honestly, the next 2 years, we're going to see some really significant changes in the types of investors that decide to show up.
And how do you define the Southeast?
Yeah, so this is a really fun question because I researched it extensively and everyone has a different definition, and I mean everyone. I define it as 10 states because I figured And this is also a whole disputable thing around what is the Midwest, right? Like, where is the Midwest? There's so many. And then is Texas its own thing? I think so. So I figured we have 50 states. We're in the bottom right corner. Let's pick 10. So that was sort of the reasoning there. So we start with, you know, Tennessee down to Mississippi, up through Kentucky, and then over up into West Virginia and Virginia, and then everything south of that.
You mentioned the money following talent and coming that way. Can you talk to me about the talent ecosystem that you're seeing in Nashville or in the Southeast and how that's going? Because talent is something that I see frequently in many of the communities that we talk to as a limiting factor.
Yeah, so I think it's incredibly strong. I think that, like any place, honestly, there's always certain roles that are hard to fill. So you'll hear people say, hey, I wish that there was, you know, a really great pool of CTOs running around. Well, guess what? That's kind of the case in every city, in every city that you go to. It's finding certain positions are tough. And so I think that overall, operating talent is incredibly strong. So knowing how to build a team, have a team be well cared for, how to actually make sure that you don't take a nosedive because you neglected everything on the operational and financial front. And then also at the same time, figuring out a way to generate revenue. I think that's a real big advantage that this region has, is that there's this understanding of how to get someone to pay you. I always call it a dollar. Like, if you can get someone to give you a dollar, you're on the right track.
Along the lines of talent, I guess I have a question about, and you've talked to a lot of people in the region, so I'm just curious on your insight. I have a stigma, and I think a certain amount of people have a stigma about the South and the Southeast being areas of poverty and limited educational opportunities. And if you look at like a Gini coefficient by state, I think the 10 states that you mentioned all fall in like the bottom probably 20. So I'm curious systemically how modern capital and how initiatives like modern capital, are they important in pushing these ecosystems forward and developing organic talent, or does it have to all come in externally?
Oh yeah, no, not at all. I would say it's both. It's local talent plus new talent that's showing up, and having a way in which those different sort of pockets of the community can actually connect in a meaningful way. And so, you know, I think working in LA on the nonprofit side, and you're talking about, you know, poverty and you know, real discrepancies in the socioeconomic continuum, you know, I think here it might be a little more visible because people are passing one another and in the same locale. And in LA, I thought it was really unfortunate that freeways really took everyone over different parts of the city. And those are the parts of the city I spent the most time in. And it was just bizarre to me how little people understood about what was going on from down, you know, just down their street. So my wish for the Southeast is that we don't become a big network of freeways, because that would be the real direction where it would go wrong. I think in the meantime, and in a non-freeway sort of orientation, the region at large really needs to think seriously about the local community and make sure that everything we're doing is involving that local community. And that's something that I think places like Memphis doing extremely well. They actually have this connectivity with what is the DNA of the city? What does the city look like? What does the city have as its history? And then how can we support these founders in building these companies? And it's no mistake, like, Memphis has a very, very high percentage of founders from diverse backgrounds that are starting businesses. And it's because that's entirely intentional. So I'd love to see that across the entire region.
A lot of our conversation here has been around your journey getting into venture, which you've said was not seamless, the way I kind of alluded to it, but something that you had to work really hard at. What advice would you give to our listeners if they were interested in pursuing a similar path and getting into the venture side?
Yeah, so this is exactly how the Venture Fellows program came about, is that I was meeting people who were saying, hey, how can I get into venture? How can I learn about this? And what I thought was really unfortunate was that their experience was that they had reached out to VCs and different firms to figure out how they could get in the door. And they were essentially told to not waste their time because it was a really competitive industry and there would be, you know, they may as well just stick with what they were doing. And so I don't accept that at all. I think that for someone who wants to get into venture, I think the number one question to answer is why? Like, what is it that you want from venture? Just because I think one misstep that I see quite a bit, and this applies to people who've been in venture and then decide to leave, is that there's this false celebrity. There's this notion that there's this power dynamic and you're sitting back and writing checks all day. And instead, I mean, I was up till 2:45 last night working on a Saturday. Like, that's kind of what happens. And so I always ask why. And then depending on what questions they might have following that, you know, I think a great way to do it is to just learn everything possible. So it's the same argument you'd make for people who are saying, well, how do I get a mentor and how can I be valuable to that mentor? It's like, well, you can be valuable in many, many ways because you can provide them with information that they otherwise don't have or maybe don't have time to generate. And so I've seen people be really creative, far more creative than myself, in getting to venture by doing things like attending every last pitch competition and collecting every deck and sending every deck to every VC and guessing their emails and just putting themselves out there and saying, hey, I'm hustling. I'm working so hard. I've learned everything. I'm never going to ask you to define a term that doesn't make sense to me because I've already Googled it and I already have read up on it and all the blogs. Like, there's never been more content out there on venture. And so I'd say really studying it. I mean, Arlan from Backstage talks about this in the many years that she spent just researching and figuring out that she just had to learn everything she could in order to play in the industry. And so I think that'd be my number one recommendation. And then separately, build your network. Like, the power of relationships in this industry is real. And so if you could go and build a totally unique network and then bring that back to a firm and have an opinion on where the world's headed, then you're already more than halfway to having a career in this industry.
What do you think venture needs more of? What type of perspective?
I think venture needs to step away from the exclusivity and a lot of the veil that's been up for a number of years. I think sort of a return to values would be really great. Like, when people were talking about Silicon Valley in several decades ago, it was a totally different place where it was way more collaborative. You know, people tell stories about their competitor sending them tech talent for the day because something crashed and they needed the extra set of hands. And I think venture needs more of that moving forward. And that's going to take the form of people who have truly unique insights. Like, that's all I look for when I'm talking to a founder, is what is their unique insight? What makes them uniquely exceptional that you can't just get off of a piece of paper? And how is that going to help their business win and be successful and not fold next month? And so I think it's the same exact thing. We need more people who have unique insights that can come in and share their view of the world and have a different perspective.
Monique, it has been awesome having you on, hearing about the mission of Modern, hearing about your story. I think the mission of Modern Capital resonates a lot with what we're doing here at Upside and connecting people and connecting players in the ecosystem outside of Silicon Valley. If people want to learn more about you, where can they find out about you?
Yeah, I'd say email me. We have an email, I think on the website, it's hello@moderncapital.co. Please send us a note. We're actually starting to host a monthly get together that's sort of a place for founders to find one another in a super casual format. So we'd love to invite you to an event. We'd love to meet you. If you're in a different city or visiting for the first time, we'd love to send you to some of our friends in some other cities that have office space you can borrow for a few days. We want to be a resource to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Monique.
So Jay, we just spoke with Monique. Curious, what are your first takeaways from her story?
I think it's always fascinating to hear how people get into venture, because it's not an easy path to get into, nor is it really a straightforward path. And so I really liked hearing about her background working at Tom's Shoes, which I can only imagine was an awesome experience at that time in Tom's history, because they were such a great story and one of the pioneers of social enterprise, really, at least how as we know it today. And then for her to move into the venture space and then find such a home there that she really enjoyed, I think something you're probably going to talk about is her talk about founders being books. That definitely stuck out to me. I know that she said it wasn't seamless, but it did seem like she's gotten through it pretty easily and it's come pretty natural to her. And I think that's awesome. And I hope other people have similar success. What stuck out to you?
I think it's crazy that she was so young when she started in venture capital. There's fellowships out there and there's scout programs, and sure, some people get in as associates, but the venture community, for how much it's talked about and how often it's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, I don't think there's more than a couple tens of thousands of people in the United States who work in it. It's a very small, tight-knit community. So to break in, you have to either have started a great company and work your way in. You have to have gone to one of the top schools and been like one of the top students who also happen to have an interest in entrepreneurship on the side. You have to start your own thing. It's very hard to break into venture capital. So I think it's very unique that she got in early. And I like that she had this experience with like international venture capital. I like that everything she did in VC was different too.
The really surprising part to me, or at least the most different part, was this period of time that she was working for Nifty, the network for teaching entrepreneurship, in the middle of that, which she said, you know, it wasn't functionally a whole lot different than venture, but it did seem like a very different opportunity. Granted, that also gave her some space to get married, and she and her husband moved to Nashville. He's a songwriter, which I think is a fun story, being a native Los Angelan and then moving to the Midwest here, I think is a testament to the Midwest. I hope it's a testament to the Midwest and not just sort of Nashville being a place for songwriters. I'm sure it's both. But like you said, I think it is aligned pretty well with what we're doing here at Upside and trying to connect communities here in the Midwest outside of Silicon Valley. It seems like she's gotten a similar bug and an interest.
I'm curious, do you consider Nashville the Midwest?
I do. Should I not?
I don't. I think that's interesting. I mean, there's really no defined line, but the Midwest to me cuts off at Cincinnati. So when you're in Kentucky, you're in the Southeast.
That's fair. And she calls it the Southeast. Let me see. What's that horrible thumbnail that TechCrunch keeps using on their articles that defines the Midwest? Let's see real quick.
Yeah, we should always use TechCrunch thumbnails to define geographic categories of the United States.
Horrible thumbnail. No, it does not. It does not rank Tennessee as part of the Midwest.
Right. And that's one of the things at Upside is we're not limited to the Midwest. We're going anywhere outside of Silicon Valley. We stayed in the United States and, well, I guess North America to date. And we have a focus around the Midwest. But we've done Nashville. We've done Birmingham. We are doing Atlanta. We've done Florida. We have some pretty unique things and overlap with Monique for sure. Jumping back into Monique and her story, I think we mentioned the difference of Nifty. I think that her venture capital experiences were very different too. And that to me was kind of like her earlier years in venture capital were almost like a training program for where she is now. In that the first one was, or she had super early stage with the accelerator. She had specific with a fintech and she had that international experience. So it's just like a lot of different facets of venture capital that she can take pieces of as she moves into this new role with Mucker and her new advocacy role with Modern Capital in Nashville.
Can you imagine, can you extrapolate what we've done in the last 6 months on the podcast and the number of founders we've talked to in the last 6 months to what somebody with Monique's background or anybody in venture, their background, the number of founders they talk to and the things they understand and the similarities they draw, the connections that come to mind immediately when they meet somebody else entering a new space?
To put some numbers behind that, we've spoke to approximately 30 founders or so in 6 months.
Specifically for the show. We've spoken to more founders than that, but on the show, recorded interviews, about 30.
I think when you think about official meetings that a venture capitalist has, let's say conservatively they have two meetings a day with a founder, similar to how we have a meeting here on Upside. That means in 15 days, they've seen as many companies as we've seen on Upside.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And every time we talk to a founder, it brings to light this idea of, oh, we should connect him to this person, which I think is probably a similar state of mind in venture all over the country. But it certainly seems to be folks that we talk to here in the middle of the country. I won't say the Midwest. I'll say outside of the Valley and the coast. People are always trying to connect one another, hold each other up, and see where they can find some parallels. And man, that would just be a never-ending, amazing carousel of introductions in that kind of world.
And I think that's why people like venture capital so much, is that it's continuously intellectually stimulating, because you could go from one meeting where someone is reinventing fintech data to another meeting where someone is building a community of rappers to another one where someone is building plush animals that look like your pet. And that's one day.
That was like an Upside bingo board, kind of like what you spent hours working on for Twitter.
Yeah, we don't need to get into the bingo board, Jay. Diving back into Monique, we talked about her VC side and getting into that and how that was super interesting and enlightening for us. I want to talk a little bit about the modern capital mission and what we can learn at Upside from that.
So modern capital is trying to connect founders, community builders, all the members of an ecosystem that should be aligned and helping hold each other up, not just in Nashville or not just in Tennessee, but in the Southeast. She's trying to bridge those geographic gaps to say, your location doesn't constrain you or define you. Let's figure out how we can best collaborate across borders. Which, yeah, you're right. I think that's completely aligned with what we're doing here at Upside. It's what we're sharing at South by Southwest. And so, yeah, I think we both relate to that.
It's funny because you were on David Sherry's podcast, No Agenda, and you brought up the deck that kind of started our discussion about Upside back when we were aptly named Project Cheddar. Little inside scoop for the listeners there. And I think on page one of that deck, I had the word archipelago written, because that's how I saw the startup ecosystems outside of the coasts. There was the Boston, New York, San Francisco contingent, where capital and information flowed freely across the three, or at least comparatively freely. And then outside of that, you had all of these little dots that weren't connected to anything else. You know, maybe Cincinnati and Columbus talked a little bit, or maybe Indianapolis and Chicago knew each other a little bit, or Milwaukee. But there wasn't really like this network effect where a startup is crushing it in Cincinnati and everybody in the Midwest region is trying to dive in. And I think that the goal of Modern is to be a bridge in the Southeast for that. And the goal of Upside, or one of the goals of Upside, is to be a bridge outside of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I think to build a network and a connective tissue that way, there's a little bit of ego that you have to release, because modern capital could be this connective tissue in the Southeast. You may have some effort started in Chicago that can connect the Midwest, and then you may have someone in the Southwest, and then those three organizations could work together. But every time there's somebody who gets really excited about wanting to be the one place for everything, there's usually an element of ego that gets introduced that actually fundamentally destroys the thing it's trying to create, which is the ability to actually connect other people. Because what you need is a collaborative spirit to work with whatever institutions and organizations exist to best serve the people you're trying to serve, as opposed to simply trying to serve the growth and existence of the organization itself.
That's awesome. I think about that all the time. I don't really think about it in terms of ego, but there are a lot of stories about when Silicon Valley was starting in the 60s and 70s and 80s, that when companies like had a big product push, other companies would just shut down for a week and like let the other company have all of their tech talent for a week so that they could make a product deadline.
I've never heard that. Is that true?
Really? I've heard it's anecdotal, so I don't know, but I think I read it on some blog somewhere. But whether it's true or not, the idea that that could have happened or did happen, I think that kind of like crazy collaboration is just like awesome.
I love that. Yeah, so excited to keep up with Monique and what she's doing with Modern Capital. And I'm sure we'll be collaborating with her and companies inside of that region for, you know, months, years to come.
And shout out to Allie Felix from Embark Collective, who was previously on the podcast and gave us the intro to Monique. We love when we get to use our network to find new, awesome, amazing people. If you, the listener, have any new, awesome, or amazing people who you think would be great on the show, we'd love an introduction. Please send us an email at hello@upside.fm or engage with us on Twitter @upside.fm or comment or like on Breaker, our preferred podcasting app.
All right, guys. Talk to you next week.
That's all for this week. Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's guest. So shoot us an email at hello@upside.fm or find us on Twitter @upside.fm. We'll be back here next week at the same time talking to another founder in our quest to find upside outside of Silicon Valley. If you or someone you know would make a good guest for our show, please email us or find us on Twitter and let us know. And if you love our show, please leave us a review on iTunes. That goes a long way in helping us spread the word and continue to help bring high-quality guests to the show. Eric and I decided there were a couple things we wanted to share with you at the end of the podcast, and so here we go. Eric Hornung and Jay Klaus are the founding parties of the Upside Podcast. At the time of this recording, we do not own equity or other financial interest in the companies which appear on this show. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinion and do not reflect the opinions of Duff & Phelps LLC and its affiliates, Unreal Collective LLC and its affiliates, or any entity which employ us. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. We have not considered your specific financial situation nor provided any investment advice on this show. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.